Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and we're starting the show today by talking about the state of aquaculture in our country. We can talk about it sort of worldwide, and we can zero in on Wisconsin as well. One of our guests, Johns Hopkins University professor Dave Love. Dave, welcome to the show.
Hi, nice to be here.
With us as well, UW-Stevens Point Northern Aquaculture Demonstration Facility Assistant Director, Tyler Furkus. Tyler, great to have you along as well.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
As we talk with them, I hope you'll join in. Do you wonder where the fish you had last Friday night at the fish fry, where that came from? Maybe you avoid eating some fish or seafood, perhaps, because you don't know its origin. Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Dave, here in Wisconsin, we have a Friday night fish fry. And if you go to California or Florida and say, hey, where's your Friday night fish fry? They're going to look at you like you're nuts, which I have done. And they have looked at me like I was nuts. Do you have that in Baltimore, Maryland?
No, we don't, actually. that's a nice tradition to add, though.
I think it's a great tradition. And I tell you what, I love the name of your center, a Center for a Livable Future. Maybe tell us about your work at that center.
Sure. It's Center for a Livable Future is within the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. And we focus on looking at the food system from farms or fisheries all the way through to the consumer, thinking about how we can make it better from an environmental standpoint, from a worker standpoint, and from a consumer health standpoint.
So you've done a lot of research in the aquaculture industry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have. Yeah.
Tyler, let's turn to you for a minute. Tell us about the UW-Stevens Point Northern Aquaculture Demonstration Facility. It's in Red Cliff, so it's away from the Stevens Point campus.
Yeah, we're located about 4 hours north of the Stevens Point campus up here in Red Cliff. But we're a part of the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point campus, of course. And it's a really unique facility that focuses on research to support the aquaculture industry. We also have a mandate to focus on demonstration of different aquaculture systems and new technologies. So we focus a lot on informing fish farmers within the state about new practices or different techniques that can improve efficiency for raising fish in Wisconsin. So we have quite a broad mandate. We also do a lot of tours to the public where we're improving education about aquaculture and fish in general. So it's a fun place to work.
It sounds like it. And I looked at the site, and it's a really nice website that you've got there with a broad range of things going on. Dave, let me go back to you, Dave Love. A new UN Food and Agriculture Organization report found that in 2022, more fish were farmed worldwide, than were harvested from the wild, possibly for the first time. What's your response to that report?
Well, this is something this is a slow-moving trend, not a big surprise. But it is a monumental moment. You think about food that we get from terrestrial ecosystems. When was the last time you got, caught a wild animal, and ate it? In fisheries, this happens every day. But in terrestrial systems, we've been farming, chickens, pigs, cows, goats for thousands of years. So the fact that we're finally flipping from farming more fish than we catch in the wild is a historic moment.
Think it's a good thing?
Yes, I think we need fish farming, and not just fish, but we've also farmed crustaceans like shrimp, mollusks like oysters, clams, mussels. A lot of seaweed is farmed. Yeah, we need a mix of farmed and wild caught. And there's a lot of interesting trends going on here. Farming's going up in most parts of the world, but our fisheries are either landings are either flat or going down, and that's concerning.
And do we know why it's going down?
Yeah. Back in the 90s, the U.S. and other countries around the world instituted better governance around fisheries. And some of those governance practices have limited the catch of certain species because we don't want to have overfishing. And we've all seen what happened to the cod fishery in the 90s off Georgia's banks. And we don't want that to repeat that in other U.S. fisheries. Mainly in Europe and North America, our fisheries are either flat or trending down while being sustainably managed. In other parts of the world, in parts of Africa and Oceania, we're seeing still increased yield from fisheries. And that might be an indication of unsustainable fish harvesting. This is from wild capture fisheries. And then if we look to aquaculture, it's a really interesting series of trends. Most of the aquaculture or farmed fish raised in the world come from Asia. And within Asia, most come from China. The rest of the world, you know, Europe, Latin America, North America, Africa, is not doing a lot of fish farming. So it's mainly Asia that's leading this global trend towards more farmed fish.
Why would that be? Why Asia?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, part of it is cultural, you know, what people like to eat. Certainly there are many countries in Asia where seafood is an important part of the diet. I'm thinking about, for example, you know, Bangladesh, coastal India, Vietnam. Fish and seafood is a big part of the diet. Of course, in China, it's a big part of the diet. And we've also got growing populations. And so these are all important trends to keep in mind. I think when you look at the U.S., you know, we're the 19th, if you rank the U.S. aquaculture production relative to global global aquaculture. So we're pretty low on the list. We used to be, we still are an aquaculture innovator. A lot of technology comes from the U.S. Hatcheries, the idea about raising fish in hatcheries, that all came from a lot of work in the U.S. About a century ago. But I think there's a lot of reticence about aquaculture in the U.S. because of environmental pollution.
Yeah. Tyler, maybe you can talk about your demonstration facility, how it's making farm fish available to consumers in the U.S.
Yeah, absolutely. So a lot of the work that we do at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point Northern Aquaculture Demonstration Facility is focused on developing techniques and doing research that helps inform both the Wisconsin aquaculture industry and the aquaculture industry nationally. So we're conducting a lot of the research that kind of helps drive some of that innovation that Dave and you were talking about. So sometimes that looks like finding new techniques to improve broodstock production for food fish production. Or sometimes it looks like doing studies on testing new feed development to see if it's suitable for the species that we raise in Wisconsin or nationally. It's really important to have a facility like this that can do that kind of research, because if you're a private fish farmer or a fish company, you don't want to dedicate some of your production facilities to doing this type of research because your livelihood is relying on that. So having a facility that can kind of do that research without relying on a private company to take some of their fishery space out of production is really important. So we do that research, and then we try to transfer our findings to the aquaculture industry to help improve efficiency or sustainable production going forward. So
I'd like to ask you both from your own perspectives, each of your perspectives, and maybe Dave, I'll start with you. What does a modern aquaculture system look like?
Yeah, that could be a lot of different things. Well, we know that we farm aquatic animals and plants in freshwater or seawater, or even estuarine water, which is a mixture. They're, you know, farmed in lakes, ponds, rivers, in the ocean, in tanks. And I think really what, when I look at aquaculture, I think about the intensity of production, you know, number of animals per liter of water. Is it a system that is fed daily, or is it called an extensive system where the animals just eat from whatever's in the pond, you know, from the wild? So there's a whole range of different types of aquaculture, you know, from high tech to low tech, depending upon the setting.
Yeah, I would think so. Tyler, what does it look like in Wisconsin?
Yeah, in Wisconsin specifically, we also have a very diverse mix of different types of aquaculture systems. So the fish farms that have been around for a long time are mostly flow-through systems that have raceways that have kind of water in and water out. And they're usually based around springs or small streams, raising rainbow trout. There's also a lot of fish farms that are focused on pond production. So ponds that maybe walleye or yellow perch are stocked in and raised out. Most of the time, those are for stocking fish into our lakes and streams for recreational angling purposes or conservation purposes. But more and more, as we go forward, aquaculture facilities are starting to be done intensively, where fish are raised completely indoors in either aquaponic systems, where fish culture is coupled with plant growth, or in recirculating aquaculture systems, which are designed so that up to 95% of the water in the system is actually reused. So it really minimizes the water footprint for the fish that are being raised. And that's kind of being billed as the future of aquaculture, especially in the Midwest, where we're focused heavily on inland aquaculture. We don't have net pen aquaculture, where there's a large pen in the open ocean or in a lake here in Wisconsin. So we're all inland based.
And there are a lot of registered, I think there's like 2,000 registered fish farms in the state.
Yeah, and that number does fluctuate every now and then, but we do have a very robust aquaculture industry in Wisconsin. So we sell, I believe, more than $14 million worth of fish food products or seafood products annually that are grown in Wisconsin. And Wisconsin's actually the number one producer in the Midwest in terms of sales of aquaculture products. Despite being number one in the Midwest, I think we're around 20th nationwide. So even though Wisconsin's got a pretty robust aquaculture industry, it's relatively small compared to some of those coastal states that have net pen aquaculture. So, and access to the oceans.
Yeah, we don't have access to oceans. We've got the Great Lakes, but we don't have access to the oceans. Dave Love, a research professor at the Center of a Livable Future, and Tyler Furkus, our guest today, assistant director of UW Stevens Point's Northern Aquaculture Demonstration Facility in Red Cliff, our guest today talking fish farming. You can join in 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here talking about how fish are raised and harvested. And I'm hoping you'll join in with your questions. What do you want to know about raising fish for food consumption or maybe stocking lakes and streams, even aquariums? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Tyler, I want to go back to you for just a minute because I was thinking about the walleye that I had to eat last Friday night for dinner. And I wonder if that was from an aquaculture system or wild caught. It's probably likely from an aquaculture system. And you're doing some research on walleye.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought it up, Larry. Actually, most of the walleye that you're going to be purchasing in a grocery store or even at your Friday Fish Fries are most likely imported from Canada from wild fish fisheries. So there's actually no surprise to you, probably quite a demand for walleye in Wisconsin and Minnesota and other Midwestern states. But yeah, we're getting most of that walleye as imports from Canada. So because there's that demand, there's a lot of impetus to figure out how to raise walleye in an aquaculture setting. So we've been doing a lot of work to try to develop walleye as a aquaculture species that's suitable to be raised in indoor systems here in Wisconsin. So pretty hard to figure that out for any new species. And walleye certainly has some specific challenges, but we've made a lot of headway on raising walleye. And we're now at the point where there's three different private fish farms focusing on raising walleye here in Wisconsin. So it's exciting to see.
It is. And I'm just thinking about the, just as an aside, the drop in walleye production seemingly in wild, in lakes across Wisconsin where bass have seemed to take over from walleye.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a concern. And it's possible that in the future, aquaculture production of walleye can kind of help make up that gap and reduce the pressure on wild fisheries from the commercial fishing operations, at least in Canada. There's a small domestic commercial fishing operation in the U.S., but yeah, it would be great to be able to supplement that with aquaculture production of walleye.
And Dave, back to you. It's an interesting thing. I was reading some of the what you've written and talked about, and there isn't a clear line between farmed and wild-caught fish. What are some commercial fish production practices that blur that line? Talk about that for a minute.
Yeah, happy to. Also, just to go back to this walleye.
Yeah.
I went and pulled some of the statistics from Great Lakes fish, the Great Lakes fishery, and Great Lakes in the U.S. produces $5.9 million a year of fish. A lot of that is walleye. So there is a pretty big fishery in the Great Lakes that really I don't think it's, you know, it's consumed locally. I don't see it down here in Maryland. That's about 1% of U.S. production. Just to throw that out there.
Yeah, thanks.
That's a lot of tribal fishing, commercial fishing rights for tribes. So Larry, you mentioned this issue about blurring the lines. What's farmed? What's wild? Well, we know that we have hatcheries all over the U.S. that produce for recreational or sport fishing, you know, whether it's trout or other species. And that's really important for the recreational market. But we also have hatcheries that produce for the commercial market. For example, up in Alaska, pink salmon is a good example. Maybe 30-40% of the pink salmon out of some tributaries in Alaska start their life off in a hatchery. And that's that hatchery technology and all the innovation that goes into that is really important. There's of course, some debate about whether we should have that many hatchery raised fish out there in the wild, what that means for fish genetics. But yeah, that's one issue. Another kind of crossing of these lines between fisheries and aquaculture is that most carnivorous species that are raised in aquaculture, for example, salmon, they do eat some fish, and that's in the form of fish meal and fish oil, which are small wild-caught fish, anchovies, sardines, and those are caught, they're crushed and pressed in, and the oil's extracted, and it's turned into a meal. That'll also make its way into pet food. A dog or cat food might have fish meal in it, but the vast majority of that fish meal is going into aquaculture. And so we're raising a lot of carnivorous species that eat a lot of fish, which is a net loss of seafood from the world. Yeah.
And the pink salmon raised in hatcheries, if they're fed, mature, released, and then caught again, they're referred to as wild caught.
Yeah, yeah. Same with lobster. The American lobster comes out of Maine. Those traps are more like hotel rooms. They're filled with bait. Lobsters come in, they snack a little bit, they might leave, they might come back. So a lot of the weight that a lobster puts on comes from bait. And a couple of years ago, there was a bait crisis in Maine. They ran out of bait. And that would really hurt the lobster industry. So people were quite upset about not having enough bait.
Let's. You mentioned salmon, and Jeff and Merrill has something relating, a question relating to salmon. Let's go there. Jeff, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, Larry, thanks for taking my call here this morning. It's not so much a question, but especially talking about salmon. I had the opportunity to tour a place in the Coulee region over near La Crosse. It's called Superior Fresh, and it is a fascinating place. They raise salmon indoors. The water that comes in for the salmon, everybody knows what salmon do when they eat, and then they have to recycle that food into the water. Well, that water then gets pumped into another building in the same place, which goes to where they raise lettuce, spring mix that we get in the store all the time, the lettuces, the leaf lettuces, the spinach. So all that water that comes in to raise the fish then goes in to raise your salad. And I find the place fascinating. I grew up as a kid hanging around a trout farm in northern Wisconsin near Mountain. And I could always taste the difference in the trout because of the pellets that they were fed in the ponds, as opposed to the taste of a wild trout. The beautiful thing about these salmon being raised at Superior Fresh, whatever they're feeding them, it's the best tasting salmon you will ever have. You don't get that pellet flavor like so many, farm-raised catfish and trouts have. It's absolutely delicious. I recommend it highly. And anybody that has a chance to look into that, called Superior Fresh, it's in the Coulee region near La Crosse. It's fascinating. It's wonderful. And I love your program.
Thanks, Jeff. Well, you guys are both nodding. Tyler, turn to you first and then to Dave. Go ahead, Tyler.
Yeah, a lot of people don't realize that we actually have the largest aquaponics facility in the world right here in Wisconsin, and that is Superior Fresh, located in Hixton. So they're a pretty impressive facility that's doing a lot of really innovative and neat things raising Atlantic salmon right here in Wisconsin. So it's really exciting to see, and really great that we have the largest aquaponics facility in the world. Right out our back door.
Yeah, that's cool. Dave, a comment?
Yeah, just shaking my head. The chief scientific officer, Steve Sommerfeld, is a good friend of mine. I was in Wisconsin a couple years ago. He invited me up to tour Superior Fresh, and it is really amazing what they're doing. And he's come after and spoken for my class, and yeah, I think it's really innovative. Growing salmon inland in tanks, I think, is the future of how to raise salmon. Because you can capture the waste. So the big problem with raising salmon in net pens in the ocean, any of the uneaten feed, and all the waste settles out, and it settles out onto the bottom. It creates this scum, dead zone at the bottom. So farms rely on siting in high flow, high energy environments. What I mean by high flow is the water moves through very quickly through the net pen, and that'll wash the waste out. You know, it might wash it out, but that waste it still exists, and there's still a lot of nitrogen and phosphorus, and that pollutes waterways, leads to eutrophication, which we hear about as dead zones. And the Gulf of Mexico is a big dead zone. From over nutrient runoff from the Midwest, but that's crop agriculture. Mm-hmm. So we really need to think about transitioning these net pens onto land so we can control the waste.
Interesting. Ellie in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Ellie.
Hi, Hi. I am a major fish nerd, and I also work in animal health in my day job, so this is a really interesting conversation. I was wondering how fish farmers and aquaculture farmers in Wisconsin are taking into account the emergence of fish disease, especially with like climate change, and thinking about whirling disease up north that's kind of making an appearance now here in Wisconsin. Just wanted to know what your guests thought about that.
Whirling disease. Well, comments start with you, Tyler.
Yeah, certainly. So in Wisconsin, the disease is certainly an issue, as it is everywhere. But we have Wisconsin DATCAP, or the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. And they help set and enforce testing requirements to prevent some of that disease transmission. So in the state of Wisconsin, anytime fish are being moved, they need to be disease tested. And there's really a lot of safeguards in place to kind of prevent farm-to-farm transmission of disease. That said, it's you know, impossible to prevent all diseases. So it really comes down to each individual fish farmer to follow best practices at their farm to make sure that disease issues don't crop up. And that involves regularly monitoring your fish, making sure to keep everything very clean, and just following SOPs that involve some of those best practices to prevent disease issues. So,
Dave, a comment from you.
Yeah, just generally, disease is a huge problem in fish farming. It's probably the number one challenge for fish farmers. And I've raised tilapia in a greenhouse, and you know, they say you're not a true fish farmer till you killed a lot of fish. Fish, you know, the big fish diseases, they'll wipe out a whole farm, and it's really concerning. There are vaccines for a lot of diseases, and where they're not vaccines, there's also antibiotics, and that's one of the concerns that consumers have is being exposed to either antibiotic residues in the fish or antibiotic resistant bacteria or superbugs that might be on farm fish. And so these are, you know, I think these are real concerns. There are a lot of the countries that export to the U.S. are doing a better job at controlling antibiotic use, but it's still a big issue. And it's one in which we need to be using, transition away from antibiotics and more to these sort of animal husbandry practices globally, you know, to control antibiotic use.
Yeah. Tyler, were you going to add something there?
Yeah, and one thing that's important to mention too is that the way we raise fish here in Wisconsin, most of the time they're not exposed to the open oceans where, you know, there's a really big need for consistent antibiotic application. So when we have recirculating systems or aquaponic systems, we can control that environment a lot more closely, and that really reduces the reliance on that. So it's less of an issue for Wisconsin-raised fish than it might be for imported fish or fish raised in a marine environment.
Yeah. Elliot mentioned the whirling disease in fish. Were you familiar with it?
Yeah, whirling disease is a disease that you see crop up in salmonids, particularly rainbow trout. And it was a really big issue out west, but it has popped up here and there further east and is a potential concern for aquaculture species in Wisconsin. So it's something to be keeping an eye on, but it's one of the things that DATCAP requires testing for before fish are moved from fish farm to fish farm. So ideally they have a good handle on where it exists in the state and have strategies out there to prevent its spread.
A caller who couldn't stay with us wanted to know if there is community-supported aquaculture like there is for other locally produced food.
Yeah, that's a great question. One that's a really, really neat operation that I want to highlight is Forest County Potawatomi has a really neat aquaponics facility that really goes a long ways for tribal food sovereignty. So that's a really neat one that I want to highlight right here in Wisconsin.
Yeah. Dave, are you familiar with any?
Yeah, I can point your viewers and listeners to the Local Catch Network, which if you Google www.localcatch.org, and then you can click on a button and find your local seafood. And that would include, community supported operations and other local fish farms and also fisheries. And so I wouldn't be surprised if there are many in Wisconsin, because this is a really popular way to get local food these days.
Does fish farming, here's another question from a listener. Does fish farming reduce the amount of mercury and other heavy metals in the fish we eat?
Yeah, that's a great question. One of the benefits of aquaculture is that we can really have a good idea of what the fish are eating specifically. Where wild caught fish, we don't really know what they've been eating, and we don't have that control over what they've been eating. So the FDA actually tests fish feeds to ensure that they're free of contaminants. And also they prohibit the use of growth hormones. They're testing for that as well. So we really have a good handle of what those fish are eating and what they're exposed to. And we can be mostly confident that farm-raised fish in most applications are free of, PCBs or methylmercury.
And what about the nutritional value of, say, aquaculture fish versus one that you caught on a hook and line? Is there any research on that? Do you know, Dave?
Yeah, I've looked into it, and our group has written about this. I think the variety that you see in nutrients really is based on the species, not whether it's farmed or wild. So there's such a wide range of different nutrients, mussels, clams, oysters, very rich in minerals. When you're thinking about fin fish, oily fish are going to be higher in omega-3 fatty acids, and those are heart promoting, oils. Shrimp is actually pretty low in omega-3 fatty acids and low in a lot of nutrients. So I would shrimp a little bit lower nutritionally. But it's good to get a variety of seafood, and the U.S. government recommends 2 meals a week is kind of the target to shoot for. 90% of Americans don't meet that. But that's not that surprising. 90% of Americans also don't eat the fruit and vegetable recommendations either. We have diets that need to change to be healthier. But seafood is an excellent source of nutrients. The big challenge for consumers is price. It's one of the most expensive proteins in the grocery store, if not the most expensive protein. So affordability is a big issue.
Talking about commercial fish farming and fish research with our two guests today, Johns Hopkins University Professor Dave Love and UW-Stevens Point's Northern Aquaculture Demonstration Facility Assistant Director Tyler Furkus. Give us a call with your thoughts. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, and we're talking about modern aquaculture practices with our two guests today. What are your thoughts on the journey fish take to reach our dinner tables? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. You mentioned, Dave, that it's as a protein source, it's kind of an expensive protein source compared to other things that we might eat. I'm wondering about the cost of farmed versus wild fish. Do we have any, and maybe have you both comment on it, but do we have any data on that?
Yeah. Both Farm and Wild come in a range of different prices. You know, you've got your luxury high-end farm fish, and you also have low-end, you know, pretty cheap frozen whitefish, frozen tilapia. Any price point you want, it's there. But generally, fish is a little bit of a frame shift up in price compared to chicken, for example.
Yeah.
Tyler, I'm curious, do you guys sell to local markets? What kind of price do you guys set?
Because we're a research facility, we don't sell the fish products. We occasionally will partner with local fish farmers, though, and help donate fish that we've started raising here for them to sell. But it really depends on the species. It is important to note, though, that the economics or the high cost of raising fish domestically is a really big part of what's slowing the growth of domestic aquaculture. So the U.S. imports 70 to 85% of its seafood products, according to NOAA, and very few or a very small makeup of the total seafood consumed in the U.S. actually comes from domestic aquaculture. And yet the cost of production is a really big part of that issue. And we talked earlier in the show about how kind of the future of aquaculture is recirculating systems or indoor aquaponics systems. And while they're great and they have a lot of benefits, they are some of the more expensive ways to raise fish. So as we go forward, we have to kind of find efficiencies within the current way that we're raising fish in those types of systems for domestic aquaculture production to really expand. And that expansion is really important too. Because we import so much of our seafood products, it really hampers the potential environmental benefits that we can have by consuming more seafood products. Because fish protein is relatively low as far as greenhouse gas emissions go compared to other forms of protein. So if we can rely more on fish, that's part of the solution. But if we have to be importing these fish from overseas, that kind of negates some of the benefit that we can get. So really kind of shortening those supply chains and growing more of our fish locally is a really important part of having aquaculture be part of a climate solution.
Are we keeping up, or are the fish farms keeping up with the growing appetite for fish worldwide?
The answer to that is yes and more. So, you know, if you plot a graph of population growth and then plot on top of it the rate of seafood production, you know, fisheries and aquaculture, we're producing more than we need. So, yes, the short answer to that is we're definitely producing enough. Again, just to remind listeners, we're also seeing a drop in commercial wild capture fish production. So we're offsetting that with more, even more aquaculture.
Yeah, I got to believe that, you know, just going out and netting wild fish is pretty expensive and environmentally not much better than raising it in an aquaculture system.
Yeah, like all things, it kind of depends. It depends on the type of species targeted, depends on the commercial fishing operation, depends on the aquaculture operation. So there's really a wide spectrum across all of fisheries and aquaculture on those costs and efficiency. So it's really hard to compare apples to apples, right?
Yeah. We've done a little look at carbon footprints within the U.S. In the U.S. seafood supply, domestic wild-caught salmon and domestic wild-caught Alaska puck shake out as two of the lowest carbon footprints. And that's, you know, I think that wild-caught fisheries do often have lower, especially if they're catching a lot of fish at once. You know, think about salmon that are returning all at once and pollock that are schooling fish that can be caught all at once. That's, you know, going pot to pot, cat to for lobster, that's a high carbon footprint. Farmed Atlantic salmon is is low, but it does have a high footprint when you ship it fresh by airplane. And 90% of the salmon, the farm salmon that comes into the U.S., it comes on an airplane.
Yeah.
It's taking a seat, but it's underneath the belly of the plane. And consumers want fresh seafood, you know. If we were more interested in frozen and thawing it at home, that would reduce food waste and it would reduce the carbon footprint from transport. So consumers have a lot of choice in the matter in what they buy and what product form, fresh, frozen, canned. So I'd encourage consumers to think about that when they're shopping. It can be overwhelming because there's lots of species out there. But there are a lot of good options within seafood.
Somebody else was wondering about shrimp. I'm thinking a few years, not that long ago, there was a lot of concern raised about the shrimp and how the shrimp were being raised, Dave, and just sort of ethical and actually ethically in terms of the shrimp, but also in terms of the final product that the consumer was getting. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think, some of the concerns around shrimp, that shrimp farming destroyed mangroves, and coastal ecosystems, that's an issue that dates back from the 80s and 90s. And I think a lot of that is under control, but those damaged mangroves still exist. There's a workforce, mainly in South and Southeast Asia, probably not paid what it should. There's a lot of risks in farming for the workers. There can be antibiotic use, as I mentioned. And now and again, products that enter the U.S. or Europe from other countries do get flagged for food safety concerns. There are also issues around wild-caught shrimp, a term called bycatch, which is that when you're targeting one species and you catch another by mistake, and the shrimp fisheries have a lot of bycatch, almost one-to-one, a pound of shrimp, a pound of bycatch in some cases. So, there are issues on both sides, farmed and aquaculture, around shrimp that we need to pay attention to.
Yeah. So what happens to those byfish?
The bycatch gets tossed overboard. Yeah. And that's really unsettling to hear. There's not often is there a market for what they're catching.
Charles in Wausau has something for us. Charles, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hey, Larry. Great fan of the show. So over in the Eau Claire area, there's a guy that takes a big swimming pool in his barn, fills it with Instant Ocean, and raises shrimp in it. And he sells that shrimp at the Eau Claire Farmers Market, and it's huge and delicious. And I was just wondering if your guests could talk a little bit more about, like, small-scale producing your own fish.
Yeah. Tyler?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, the Wisconsin aquaculture industry is pretty small scale, with a few exceptions. You have your Superior Freshes that are very large, but by and large, most fish farms in the state are pretty small operations, which is really neat. And it's honestly great to be able to go visit some of your local fish farms and purchase the products that they have there. It's really neat to be able to see how they're raised. And get your seafood products locally and avoid those supply chain issues and having to worry about if the fish that you're purchasing came here by airplane, right? So that's one of the great things about being in a state like Wisconsin that has a pretty robust but very kind of locally based aquaculture industry.
Yeah. Go ahead. You were going to add something here, Dave.
Oh, well, I think you can farm fish in any size container. We bring 200 gallon, 300 gallon tanks into classrooms and do it in schools. The kids love it. We usually stock with tilapia. It's pretty forgiving. The main thing is, put a water heater in, and the kids need to feed the fish once a week, not, a couple times a week, not too much, but you can farm fish. You can do it.
By the way, what was the original name of tilapia? That was a public relations thing. I think it had an awful name. Do you guys remember?
I can't put us on the spot like this, Larry. I don't know.
It had just a terrible name, and they switched the name from that to tilapia, and suddenly sales of tilapia jumped.
Yeah. There's another fish, Pangasius. It's a type of catfish. It's raised in Southeast Asia. It's one of the top imports into the U.S., but you won't see Pangasius on any restaurant menu. You'll see catfish, but it's probably Pangasius. I mean, outside of the Southeast, where there is a lot of U.S. farm catfish.
Oh, man. Jonathan had emailed to say they love eating fish, lived in Japan for several years and met people who didn't really consider fish meat. And Jonathan realized in our culture as well, fish is a meat alternative with connections to the Catholic tradition of Fish Fry Fridays, as we've been talking about. Can you speak to people thinking that fish is a meat alternative?
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of people are trying to transition away from red and processed meat for health reasons. It's high in saturated fat. There's a lot of risks around eating red meat and processed meat. And so from a health standpoint, fish is a great alternative, as are, you know, beans, legumes, peas, so from that standpoint, yes. Tyler mentioned the carbon footprint. So, if you put protein foods on a scale, you know, beef is off the charts high in carbon footprint. After that, pigs. After that, chickens. Now, fish is actually a seafood is a bit of a range. You know, it ranges from pigs to chicken or below. And it really depends on the farming or fishing practice. But the average, the average fish probably is around the carbon footprint of an average of raising chickens. And then below chickens, you know, you've got your plant-based proteins. So, I think people are looking for alternatives to red meat, and seafood is one of them.
You know what, Jill Nadeau just reminded me, I mentioned tilapia in a different name, but actually the original name of orange roughy was, they called them slime heads. And they changed the name of slime head to orange roughy. She's right. They changed it to orange roughy, and sales of orange roughy shot through the roof.
That really highlights how important marketing is. It's probably why we don't have a robust crappie aquaculture industry, right? Hard to market that, even though if you're from here and fish, you know they're great fish. But
caught a lot of crappies in my day and enjoyed them all. And I would, if I had too many, I'd throw them in a milk carton, fill it with water, and freeze the fillets. And they would always taste fresh if it's done that way. Dave, Tyler, thank you so much for being with us today. It's a real pleasure talking with you about the aquaculture industry. I hope we can do it again. But in the meantime, thanks you very much. Dave Love, research professor at the Center for a Livable Future at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health in Baltimore, Maryland. Tyler Firkus is assistant director of UW Stevens Point Northern Aquaculture Demonstration Facility in Red Cliff. Coming up, we're going to take a look at some water trails, not hiking trails, but water trails. I'm Larry Mueller. Mm-hmm. Thanks for staying with us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. You know, Wisconsin is home to several state and national waterways. And in 2022, the Great Pinery Heritage Waterway earned its state designation, but it could also win some national recognition next year as well. I'm going to talk about what that means for you and for me with our two guests. We're talking with Bill Bertram. Bill is board president of the Wausau and Marathon County Parks Foundation. Bill, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Also with us, Darren Bush, owner and chief paddling evangelist of Rutabaga Paddle Sports in Madison. And Darren, always great to have you with us. Thanks for joining in.
It's always great to be here. Thank you.
So as we talk with our two guests, I hope you'll join in. Does your bucket list include maybe a multi-day paddling camping trip to the Wisconsin River, perhaps? Did you know the river includes Whitewater Kayaking Park in downtown Wausau? We can talk about that. Worried about national designation or what that might mean to overcrowding on the river? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. Bill Bertram, let's get some basics out of the way. Tell us, what is the Great Pinery Heritage Waterway?
Yeah, Larry, it was actually the concept of the waterway goes back to 1987, with then-Governor Thompson had an idea of a head-to-toe trail on the Wisconsin River, starting at its headwaters and dead-ending as it enters the Mississippi. At that time, the lower 92 miles were developed up to the first dam, and because of the dam owners at that time, the trail was never extended north. And then in 2021, in December, our board decided to do more impactful projects, and this was the first of those projects. So this is a 108-mile water trail from Hat Rapids in Oneida County, and it dead ends in Lake DeBay Dam in Portage County.
Wow. What's the story behind the name?
Yeah, you know, we originally had a different name on the trail, and what's unique about the trail is the historical storytelling from ancient times through the mid-20th century, and the historical societies in Merrill and here in Wausau thought that the white pine and was a defining point for northern Wisconsin. So obviously it became the Great Pinery Heritage Waterway because of the attraction of the lumbermen and coming up river. It goes back to a survey done in 1837 by Joshua Hathaway on the Treaty of the Cedars that opened up this part of the river to back then to Big Bull Falls.
Yeah, that's a pretty cool story. And so in 2022, the trail was designated a state waterway. What is a designated state waterway, Bill?
Yeah, so when we approach the state, they have 20 state designated waterways. And part of this is having defined landings and actually taking some of Darren's ideas at Rutabaga. We decided to use GIS locators and do a technology play, QR codes and stuff, in terms of not just the history, but also where all those landings are located at. And then before we developed a map, we put the maps on most of the popular water apps. And so the state looked at that and said, you know, you need a map. And we just took it a step further based on technology to make it more mobile with social media with today's recreational paddlers.
Yeah, and you wonder how soon, let's put it that way, could the waterway win designation as a national trail?
Yeah, so we actually are in the second year of a grant with the National Park Service. Their water trail conservation group, they picked this trail to work with us on. And so November 1st of this year, we will submit an application for National Water Trail designation. There's two types, scenic and recreational. The northern part of our trail is very scenic. The second largest water, you paddle around the second largest waterfall in the state of Wisconsin at Grandfather Falls. And we're applying for recreational designation. And so we'll find out sometime after the first of the year, probably February, March. This has to be passed by Congress. And then next June on Trail Day, they'll tell us a little bit before that. But then if we're successful, we'll have a ribbon cutting in and around that date of 2025.
Let me turn to Darren, to you. Wisconsin already, and Bill mentioned this, we already have several national water trails. Maybe you can mention some of them and then talk about what has federal recognition meant for those rivers.
You know, it's funny, is I'm not super familiar with the ones in Wisconsin. That's Bill Bailiwick, but I've worked on them at the national level, but that was 25 years ago. And Bill knows this well. The Northern Forest Canoe Trail was sort of the first really good cooperative program between public and private entities. And it runs from Old Forge, New York, up to Katahdin in Maine, basically. And it loops over into Canada for a short period of time. The good thing about that is they went to, like, the timber companies and said, hey, can we put a campsite on your land? And they went, well, no. And they said, well, what if we pay for it and promise to keep it clean and do all the work? And they went, yeah, okay, fine. If it doesn't go well, we'll just kick you off. Well, they educated the people that were paddling it and put signage up, and it people understand it's a privilege, right? So public and private landowners come up with this beautiful trail, and I've paddled some big chunks of it, and it's moving water, it's flat water, it's all different biomes, so it's pretty cool. But it took a long time to get that. I think it's 700 and something miles, Bill, do you know?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that's about the correct mileage on it, yeah.
But it was kind of the first one to really do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
yeah.
People are taking, I mean, smart people. What's that line in academics? It's like to steal from one person is plagiarism, to steal from everybody is research, right? So the smart people that are doing water trails like Bill are going, well, there's already a model. Let's just take it and adapt it to us.
Yeah. And what models did you use, Bill, for the trails that we have here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, you know, we looked at half a dozen trails around the United States, but for the most part, kind of focused on recreational trails. So the fabulous Fox Trail in southeast Wisconsin, the Milwaukee River Trail. We looked at the St. Croix National Trail, and then with the help of the National Park Service, they were able to give us an additional maybe half dozen trails around the United States that they felt that was best in class. Being a good listener, I met with Darren, and he had a lot of big ideas. And we kept pivoting around his ideas, got in front of the Department of Tourism, Office of Outdoor Rec, and they said, you know, initially another water trail. And we said, well, this is really different because each landing on the trail, there's 35 of them, either landings or portages between the trailhead at Hat Rapids and the Lake to Bay Dam. We have storyboards there that tell the history of the river as you come down. They're tied back to an idea that Aaron had in terms of QR codes that tie back to the museums to give you additional information on the river and the history of the river. And that's what's really unique about this trail. It's not just a paddle trail. It's a paddle trail that tells the history of one of the great rivers in the United States.
Yeah, pretty cool, Darren. That was a great idea.
Okay. I have a vague recollections of talking to Bill about this. But he's right, is the connection to the land and to the water is really important. And a good example of people figuring this out is in, if you look in Prairie du Sac, all the buildings on that main street used to have their backs turned to the river, right? It was like, that's where you throw stuff, right? And now you're seeing people put, like the Culvers put a patio in the back, and people are flipping their attitude to make the river actually something scenic and beautiful to look at rather than a place to dump stuff. So it's nice to see that happening. The Northern Forest Canoe Trail, one of the things that happening there is all the landings. It's they don't have the same technology we do because we're ahead of them, I guess, now. But a lot of the trail paddles through places that are fairly rural in, like, New Hampshire, where the locals don't have anything to do with the river. It's basically just there. They're usually the economy isn't very good, and they're struggling with other things. So the recreational aspect of the river is, like, the last thing they're thinking about. But people stop, and people go to the stores, and they spend money. And that's the best thing about going through these rural areas, is that it does bring in an economic impact. And they are starting to see that, hey, there's a benefit in keeping the river clean and in maintaining landings and camping areas.
Yeah, it's we've kind of had that ethic, I mean, in this state. You think about it, you guys. I mean, somebody once on the show compared, he was from Illinois, and not to denigrate Illinois, but at the time he said, you know, most of my friends think about water in Illinois as a place to get from one point to another, or to carry goods from one place to another. But here in this our state, we tend to look at it more from an environmental and natural look.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And there's great value in having a water trail for, I mean, economic value is one thing. And I'm actually on the committee for the Office of Outdoor Rec, and we talk a lot about there's an economic impact. And outdoor activities are the largest sector in Wisconsin. If you combine them all together, hunt, fish, paddle, everything like that. You know, and mining is like 0.9%, and we're pushing 11, I think.
Yeah.
So it's when people talk about the jobs that come from mines, it's like, great, but this you can't export paddling, right? you can't make paddling in China. So it's going to be jobs that are going to be local all the time.
Katina in Green Bay, we'll go to you. Thank you for calling.
Hi there. Well, first of all, I want to thank Darren for hosting Canoeacopia, because in 2010, I actually learned about the Northern Forest Canoe Trail, and I've through paddled it twice, and I just got back from Maine doing another section of it.
Wow.
So I'm very active and very knowledgeable about the Northern Forest Canoe Trail. But because of that, I since went on, I paddled the Wisconsin River from source to mouth, and I do have a question about the section that we're talking about today. But I also wanted to say that my granddaughter is 10 years old, and we just got back yesterday. We did an overnight on the Peshtigo River flowage and camped on Calden Falls. So I've introduced her to paddling, all because probably Canoeacopia and learning about paddling on the Northern Forest Canoe Trail as an expedition. So thank you for that. My question is, so when I paddled in the Wisconsin River in 2019, I found a resource called the Wisconsin Centennial Trail that had information about the whole trail, but it was kind of defunct. I should also say I've also done the Fox River. It was called the Fox River Heritage Trail, and that organization seems to be non-existent anymore, and it kind of cobbled together an expedition on the Fox River from Portage to the mouth of Green Bay, where I live. So can you speak, I guess, to if what's the Centennial Trail part, if that's still in existence, or just expand upon more about the pinery heritage and the infrastructure that makes it possible to do a source or a long distance overnight trip?
Well, Bill, let's turn to you for that.
I was going to say, great question. And so what made the trail, call it feasible, was that all the landings were already cut in by either the state, the county, or a parks department along the trail. And what made the trail then possible was that early Centennial Trail back in 2007, the Wisconsin Valley Improvement Company, in honor of their 100th year centennial, they created the Centennial Trail from the head to the toe. And they got permission to cross the dams at that time on a right-of-way. So we found that kind of older trail, and then we built the Great Pinery on that. We moved, as an example, instead of coming down the main channel, we went to the left or right bank. We also measured, call it Wi-Fi connectability along the trail, thinking in today's world it's social media. And then we updated the maps and made it back to what Darren was saying. It was really, we looked at it as an economic driver. We had a destination software where we managed, created a map of the trail so we can measure every paddler on the river on the trail link now. And so as an example, we had a 14% increase in paddlers last year, almost 12,000 paddlers on the trail. So we're able to measure that and then treasure it and then get that back to communities to say, here's why you should invest in the trail. The National Park Service, one of the gaps they identified, there wasn't enough camping on the water trail. So there's 7 existing campsites today, and we're in the process of developing 20 more water-accessible, primitive, dispersed camping on either islands or on DNR property or on private land. And so that's in the process now of the master plans have been opened up with the DNR where we've given them GIS locators where those campsites should be on public property like Bill Cross or Menard Island. And we think that for through paddlers, it acts as a really great dimension to know where those campsites are at, how you reserve them, and will enhance the trails in future years.
Bettina, does that help out?
Oh, sure. I think infrastructure is really important to encourage paddlers to utilize these areas. And I heard a little bit when I was on hold, the Northern Forest Canoe Trail has definitely been the communities through which those rivers and areas the trail passes has definitely, I think, impacted in a positive way the communities. And you're seeing there's more events being planned and more awareness, and it is helping some of those towns that have been devastated by economic changes, like with paper mills closing and whatnot. So I'm excited about any water trail, so this is great.
Thank you very much for calling.
Why haven't we paddled together yet? I don't understand. Well, that would be wonderful.
Yeah, that was great. Yeah. Thank you so much for that call. Here we are visiting with Bill Bertram as board president of the Wausau and Marathon County Parks Foundation and Darren Bush, owner of Rutabaga Paddle Sports in Madison and chief paddling evangelist for Rutabaga. Questions for them, I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. The Great Pinery Heritage Water Trail includes more than 100 miles of the Wisconsin River. Have you paddled it? Do you recommend paddling a different state or national waterway in Wisconsin? Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org, and we'd love to hear from you. Let's go to Mary Kay in Kenosha. Mary Kay, thank you for calling.
Hi, I'd like to talk about the Wisconsin River by Wisconsin Dells. I would like to see the river and the cliffs stay like they are, the sandbars stay like they are, canoeing up there. And it's a scenic trail, okay? It's not for like a million people to go up there all at one time. So can we keep that wild?
Actually, you know, it's interesting as a lot of it is. I mean, north of the dam, Black Hawk Island and around there, there's a lot of recreational use, like the ducks and the jet boats and stuff like that. I don't go there till October. I mean, I go there in October, I don't see a single person. And she's right. It's absolutely stunningly beautiful. I mean, the Bennett photographs don't do it justice. And it's H.H. Bennett, was that who it was?
Yeah.
Yep, yep.
Yep. The photographer.
Yep. And then below the dam, actually, Lake Delta down there is also really lovely. And I don't see a lot of boats on that. The people don't see the river when they go to the Dells unless they're in a duck. It's kind of, they go there for other reasons, right? But Mirror Lake is stunningly beautiful.
It's stunning. Yeah, it is. Yeah. Bill, a comment from you.
Yeah, you know, we look at this as kind of a segment trail. Headwaters to the trail inception point is a place called Point Boss that was kind of opened up the Northwoods back in 1837, and then the Central Sands area. But yeah, the more scenic, the more wild it remains, is the more people that are today driven to that type of adventure. And yeah, we would support that 100%.
Alan in Ripon will give you a chance. Hi, Alan.
I was going to refer to the fact that I did a paper on transportation on the Wisconsin River when I was at University of Wisconsin in Stevens Point right after World War II. And I was interested in the fact that when I looked at the old Pinery publication, which is a newspaper, they always talked about transportation on the river in naval terms. So it was always a captain this or captain that. It was so interesting that the railroad came about that same time. And when the railroad came, all the thing changed. And there were the little tugboats that went between Little Bull Falls at Bozenee and Wass's Big Bull Falls, and I suppose the other tugs would reform going up to Grandfather Falls. But I just commented on that Pinery newspaper that might be of interest to you.
Oh, thanks for calling. Bill, are you familiar? You know, you're a kind of a history guy. Are you familiar with that?
You know, I'm not, but I've made a note to you know, based on those comments, to follow up on that, because, you know, it's been really interesting with the development of the trail. You know, in today's world, you can't get two politicians of the same party to agree to anything. When we came up with the concept of the trail from Tomahawk all the way down to Stevens Point, we had 100% buy-in from the counties, the municipalities, Chamber of Commerce's, in all of those communities. And we started to getting tidbits of information from people. The Norwood 1847 discovery exploration to try to find the headwaters of the Wisconsin and his journals. And so, yeah, we'll follow up on that because it's been an interesting study for myself and for others to look at this history, because it's usually just a generation deep. And we're actually on our website, because of the historical societies, they've done podcasts now on historical bridges on the Wisconsin. And they've got one coming up on it's the most dammed river in the world, hardest working river in the world. But most of these dams are historic in nature. They go back to the early dams in the late 1860s and the dams that are there today in early 1900s. And so, yeah, any information we get on the river is always exciting. And then we're on our website. We have a heading that says history, where we disseminate that back and then tie back to the historical societies for more information. So, yeah, I appreciate that. Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
It's really cool. I've always wondered, when I paddled down the lower Wisconsin, we passed several bridges that are swing bridges. I mean, they're clearly made, the railroad bridges, and you can look at the ironwork underneath, and I'm a blacksmith, so I geek out of that stuff. But clearly the river's not deep enough to carry any sort of traffic. So they must have been there for like a week, and then they decided not to dredge anymore or something. But it's interesting that they're there.
Well, Fritz Albert, who was a professor in the Department of Agricultural Journalism at the University of Wisconsin, produced a film. Bill, I don't know if you're familiar with it. It's probably in the, I'm sure it's in the archives of the State Historical Society on the Wisconsin River, and called it, again, was Wisconsin River was the most working river in the world.
Right, 23 dams?
I think there were something like 23 dams that were generating electricity.
Yeah, plus being able to float lumber. So
and
yeah,
being able
things.
To float lumber. Were you, did you ever see that film, Bill?
No, but I just made a note for that too, Larry, because I'm going to look it up.
Yeah, Fritz Albert was the film guy. He was a great film producer.
Yeah, thanks.
And so it's another thing to look at. Alan, thank you again. You can join in.
Much.
Yeah, you can join in too. The number's 800-642-1234 or email to talk at wpr.org. So the Pinery, the Great Pinery Heritage Waterway, it's, as you say, it's more than 100 miles long. How long would it take to paddle the whole way?
You know, I've done sections of it. And there's a couple that I work with in Lincoln County, Chris and Candy Schatz, and Candy's a five-time head-to-toe paddler of it. On this section, it would be, depending on how many hours you want to paddle per day, but it's probably, a week to 10 days with camping. And it's interesting on this section, too, Larry. If you go from Rhinelander, we start outside of the Rhinelander area down to pick on Nacoosa or Wisconsin Rapids, the fall of the river in this section is equivalent to like two Niagara Falls.
Oh.
So it has one of the greatest drops of any river east of the Mississippi over a really small section. And the Wisconsin's kind of like four different rivers with the same name Wisconsin, and how they were geologically kind of developed. But this section is before the damming was just it was a really incredible wild river. The falls at Grandfather Falls were 94 foot. There's still a number of rapids on the river, Whirlpool Rapids and Poise Rapids and Bill Cross Rapids, and that are class one to class three. But it offers every paddler, and we put that on our website too. Kind of, we rate the river in terms of family paddling and ease and difficulty based on water levels and on that. So it's 10 days of fun paddling up in the Northwoods and a lot of wildlife from occasional bear to a lot of deer and just full of eagles. So yeah.
And the goal kind of is, isn't it, to make a waterway a destination for paddlers who may be willing to spend more than a day on the river?
Absolutely. I'm a really nerdy kind of a researcher on the data, and there was a study done that only 3% of paddlers are through paddlers, multiple day trips, and about 7% are 4 hours or greater. And most of them are recreational paddlers, 4 hours left. I think it's like 87% of paddlers. And we thought by using social media and some of the other technology plays, the goal is to get more through paddlers and to make it more, as Darren said, what's the economic impact of that? And for communities that are more rural in nature, and then embrace the river. And that is our long-term goal is the through paddlers.
Shelley in near Beaver Dam has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Shelley.
Hi, how are you?
Great, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
what a terrific program. You have kept me entertained on my drive from the land of Lincoln to the Dairy State. A couple of things. I wondered if you were familiar with this extraordinary exhibit called Soul of the River, which is in downtown Wisconsin Dells, right on the river, appropriately.
I'm not.
No, I've to be honest, I've not spent much time actually in the Dells.
Yeah.
Photographer's name is Joseph Lute, and he's from the Dells and studied photography, art photographer, but has done a beautiful exhibit. It's actually outdoors. And I know it sounds crazy to say it's right in the middle of downtown Dells, but suspend that for a minute and realize it's just an extraordinary exhibit that talks about the river, history, just every aspect that you've been talking about today. We have a place on the Upper Dells, which you probably know is what locals refer to the river that's above the dam. For years we were a lake family up in Manitowish Waters, but have really come to appreciate the river. And I agree with you, October is the time to be out there in a canoe. But if you have a chance to see this exhibit, it really pays homage. He pays homage to H.H. Bennett, who you referenced before, but has really brought kind of a contemporary, also historic kind of plant to the river itself. It's really a gem.
Well, Shelley, thank you so much for calling. Well, something else to take a look at here.
I'm going
to
go there.
I am too.
Yeah.
I'll meet you for lunch, Bill.
No, it sounds great.
It's about halfway.
Yeah, my treat. Yep. You give so much, so.
Yeah, thank you, Shelley. Joseph in Madison. Madison, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I had a question about a cow fence that goes across the creek, the Black Earth Creek. We came through there a while back, and it was extremely dangerous with where we kind of almost got caught under a cable that is on the side. So just any information about that, or how, you know, the best way when you approach that fence, where should you go over it, like on the sides or direct in the middle?
Over it? I don't go over them. Usually, if people don't know what this is, it's basically a wire or a line across the river with boards of or plastic or anything like PVC pipe 3-4 feet long that go down to the top of the water. And the reason it's there is to keep cows from going up or downstream. So they'll put them where near a cow path might cross the river. And some of them are 2x6s or 2x8s or 2x12s, and they're getting through them is tough. I'd recommend portaging around them whenever you can. Some of them are PVC pipe, and you just kind of blast right through them. But yeah, when you come around the corner and you current, and there's this thing in front of you, it's intimidating. And I agree with you.
Joe, thank you for calling. Nathan in Prairie du Sac, it's your turn. Hi, Nathan.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was just kind of wondering, if someone is coming down the river or whatever, like camping sites and stuff, and how that works, you know, if you have to find the right place to camp, you know, like overnight.
Yeah.
So my understanding is you can camp on the lower Wisconsin Riverway anywhere below the high tide mark, and that is not private property. So that means pretty much sandbars. And this is another thing that I was going to ask Bill that I don't know, is if you can make a national or a state waterway a legit trail. And the reason for that is that the lower Wisconsin River is heavily used, and it is also heavily abused. So I take an onion sack with me when I paddle, basically just, you know, things you get onions in, but I can stuff them full of trash that I find, and then they drain. So I can just hang it up and let it drain, then throw it in my canoe. I always pick up at least a bag whenever I paddle, and plus disposing of human waste, there's no place to do that, and so that gets kind of dicey. Yeah. And there's no fire pans. So I would love to see that turned into some sort of state water trail where there is more stewardship, but also just more, make it easier for people to do the right thing.
And Bill, let's talk about the stretch that we're dealing here with, the Great Pinery Heritage Waterway, in terms of camping and so forth, and how people find, you mentioned this earlier in the show, but there are campsites available that people can find.
Yeah. So, you know, right now, this was identified by the National Park Service as a gap in our first grant last year with them. And they actually have been working with the Wisconsin DNR, as well as the Department of Interior Bureau of Land Management, to find those designated spots along on public land. So right now there's seven campgrounds, some private, some public, on the river. Far too, not enough. But as we go forward on the website, we'll be adding those campsites as well as future campsites as they become available, either on private or public land, and then using GIS locators. So you know exactly where those are at when you're paddling on a paddle app. And unlike the lower Wisconsin, we don't have the number of sandbars up here. And but it's interesting with the team that kind of manages the lower Wisconsin, their executive director, we've worked close with him. And then he also weighed in heavy with the Bureau of Land Management to say, okay, what islands are actually considered to be public where we could have more dispersed camping, but what does that camping look like from the DNR's perspective in terms of pit pots and the like? You know, Darren's comments are in terms of human waste and are a concern. And then on the Lake DeBay portion, it's one of the civic organizations there that the two campsites that are there, that they maintain them and keep them clean, and as a friends group of the river.
We are talking today about, well, we're talking paddling and we're talking about rivers, and we're zeroed in on the Great Pinery Heritage Waterway with our guest today, Darren Bush of Rutabaga Paddle Sports, and Bill Bertram, who's board president of the Wausau and Marathon County Parks Foundation. Great to have you with us here on WPR News. I'm Larry Mueller. Tomorrow on the Larry Mueller Show, we'll talk about home improvement projects and setting up a smart device home network. That's tomorrow at 11. But right now, we are talking about the Great Pinery Heritage Waterway along the Wisconsin River. It's a 108-mile trail. With our two guests, Bill Bertram and Darren Bush. It's great to have them with us as well. Questions, give a call, 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. I wanted to mention the whitewater part of the trail. Bill, can you talk about that?
Yeah. So, at the heart of the trail is the Wausau Whitewater Park, urban whitewater. They have 10 releases a year. And as an example, we just had a paddling club came over to flatwater paddlers to do the Heritage Trail, the Great Pinery. But then they camped downtown Wausau on those water releases, and I think there were 16 of them. Eight of them got certified to do whitewater paddling on that Sunday on these open water releases that they have. And it was an incredible experience. You know, you paddle the Great Pinery on one side of Clark Island, and on the other side is the urban whitewater trail. And Darren and his team is up here, I think, a couple times a year, supporting that trail and lessons and you know, access to boats for that type of paddling. But yeah, it's a real asset to the trail, and one of the few that you can do both types of paddling.
It's interesting, Darren, and you do get up there.
Yeah, it's more than a couple times. I've got a Dan on staff is a hardcore whitewater paddler, so he goes up both for his own enjoyment, but the public releases are really a big benefit. The other thing is it's a professional course. So like some of the team trials for Worlds for Whitewater are going to be held there this summer. And there's just a lot of attention from outside of Wisconsin, even, you know, like I said, national and international organizations mm-hmm. using it.
Katina had called her, who had called earlier, emailed, wanting to reassure other listeners that marked portages exist all around all the dams, and kudos to the hydroelectric companies that maintain them. Also said that shuttle services might be helpful to encourage more through paddlers of water trails. And signage along the river to make known that burgers and beer can be had in the small towns yeah. along the river would be helpful too. Bill?
Yeah, so, you know, great question. We're in the process of developing a interactive map for the trail versus the downloadable static maps we have on the segments, as well as on the website we have all the trail guides, water trail guides, that pertain to these sections of the river. The trail guide that we're developing is segment by segment, and it will have, if you want to stop in Merrill for a beer or piece of pie up by Grandfather's Falls, there's a little cafe up there along the river, that'll all be designated, and it'll be in real time, so it'll be a great trip planner. As well as all the portages are marked and the distances in portages, not in terms of rods, but in terms of feet. And in addition, it's where there are ADA landings, and then we also standardize on the river with a specific manufacturer. So you don't even have to get your feet wet to get into the water or get out of the water. I think we have 11 universal dock launch systems, and I think 3 or 4 ADA approved dock launch systems on the trail now. And that's really, it's been the civic clubs that have kind of bellied up to the bar to put those in on the trail length. And again, the interactive map has, you know, very, very specific history bits as you come down on it for a planning tool, hotels, those campgrounds, and where you might see certain types of bird or wildlife. We work with the Wisconsin bird clubs, kind of like where that the best place to spot a, you know, wildlife at. So yeah, and that'll all be on there shortly.
Yeah, and we haven't given the site itself, which I think we have probably a link up already on our Larry Mueller Show site. But how do people just type? If you type in the name Great Pinery Heritage Waterway, is that going to get you to the site?
It will. And if you just type in Great Pinery, it'll get you to the site. And and you know, early on, and this goes back last year, Darren gave us space at Canoocopia, and that was really kind of the launch of the trail, and we had just overwhelming response. We were back this year with trail maps. I think we ran off something like 500 maps on the segments, gave every one of them away by day 2 of Canoocopia. And it was like, you know, we thought we'd have be bringing maps back, but it was just the opposite. And the other thing is kind of neat is the call it the merchandising of the trail. I lived in the Netherlands, and there is a trail over there, kind of a pilgrimage trail called the El Camino, where you get stamps based on the El Camino trail, and they all flow to a very specific spot in Spain. we took that idea to create a adventure map with stamps that we'll be introducing for people to get stamped along the way. And then at the end of it, we would get a free Great Pinery Heritage Waterway T-shirt. And they had a little local coffee company that just brews. It's called Riverside Dark Blend. And it's called the coffee company here is called the Pinery. And they, you know, we, you know, highlight them, and you can go in and get a cup of coffee that tastes and smells like a smoky wood fire in the Northwoods. So, and we got a beer company now that's interested in coming up with a Pinery summer shanty beer for us. So it's actually interesting to see how the business community has gotten around the trail. And back to Darren's comments, I mean, so many of our communities have turned their back on the river, and now they, you know, they face it and say, my gosh, this is a way to drive, you know, economics and you know, into our communities with really great people that on that. So
somebody else wondered, and you've been talking about segments. What is a typical length of a segment?
Yeah, that's a great question. When we looked at the data for typical paddlers, we try to keep the segments in 4 or 8 hour blocks, and realizing that's how most people paddle if you're not a through paddler. So the landings are all kind of 2 hour paddles from each other. And then they're into, and the bigger segments are up north in Lincoln County, a little bit more rural, much more scenic, and not as many landings on those. But we try to keep these in that 2 to 4 hour type range before your bottom gets tired in the bottom of your kayak, and you say, "Yeah, I got to get out and walk around." And on that, so
you need a different seat. Yeah, that doesn't happen to me.
Yeah, I need a different seat.
Oh boy. Well, Lauren in Eau Claire emailed to say that Lauren, she says she grew up in going to YMCA Camp Manitou and went on to lead canoe trips as a young adult, fell in love with Wisconsin and its rivers. Her favorite trips include the high water flows in June on the Brule River, which empties into Lake Superior. Lauren said they are really looking forward to trying the Great Pinery Heritage Trail now that they have learned about it. So that's kind of a cool thing.
It is. Very cool. Come on over. Is Eau Claire, I belong to Pure Water Paddlers over in Eau Claire. And so I paddle over there quite a bit. And so I know their waters, but I have to be honest, we have better water.
Well, I tell you what, it's been great fun talking with both of you, and I really appreciate it. The Great Pinery Heritage Waterway, you've certainly gotten my interest up to get up there and try some of those segments out.
Let's do one of those WPR trips that Larry leads instead of going to Europe or whatever. We'll just go up to Eau Claire, right?
That'd be kind of fun. I kind of like that idea.
I'm in.
Yeah. Well, anytime.
Well, thanks to you both very much, Bill and Darren. Bill Bertram is board president of the Wausau and Marathon County Parks Foundation. Great supporter, obviously, and did a lot of work on the Great Pinery Heritage Waterway. Go online, take a look at it. I think you're going to like it. Darren Bush, owner of Rutabaga Paddle Sports in Madison, our chief paddling evangelist with us today as well. And we'll get them both back and we'll talk again. And thank you for listening. Remember, these shows are a team effort. Our producers, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnaud, our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins. Our executive director is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you so much for listening. Stay with us. Lots more in store on WPR News. See you soon.